This is Colorado Edition from KUNC. On today's show, tribes along the Colorado River have historically been left out, but that's beginning to change.
We want our full allocation. We want our water. We want to utilize it.
How tribal leaders are calling for a seat at the negotiating table over the river's management.
And how the process of gathering signatures to get a question on the ballot works here in Colorado.
Plus, a look at the future of transportation funding in our state.
All that and more coming up.
It's Monday, November 18th. You're listening to KUNC's Colorado Edition, your look at news from around the state. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. This week, the town of Estes Park will send out ballots for the December 10th special municipal election, which has one question on it. Should the sale of marijuana be allowed in the town of Estes Park? Here to tell us more about this special election is Avery Martinez, a reporter for the Estes Park Trail Gazette. Avery, welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thank you. I really appreciate that. I'm very glad to be here.
In 2012, the Estes Park Town Board voted to ban the sale of marijuana products after it was legalized statewide in terms of recreational adult use. So how did this question get on the ballot in Estes Park?
In 2019, actually, it's kind of interesting. The Town Board of Trustees, actually, they had the opportunity to just allow marijuana sales. They had that power. Mm-hmm. And they could have done that. But instead, they decided to leave it to a vote of the people. And that became the special election that's going on now. And there were a lot of different details to it. One of the main things that they said is that it had to come to the board basically from a citizen-initiated ordinance. And so basically what that meant was that somebody in the community or a group had to come forward and they had to create an ordinance and they had to produce it. So in July of this year, two residents did submit an ordinance petition that had 271 ballot signatures signed by registered Estes Park voters. A minimum of 238 ballot signatures were needed. So they were almost 40 over the minimum to get it on the ballot.
Walk us through the debate then. What are some of the key arguments for and against?
Well, I would say that one of the big challenges, I don't know if it's for or against, happens to be that people seem pretty divided on the issue up here. One of the big things is that people like the Larimer County Sheriff, Justin Smith, have spoken quite openly and many times about different effects that marijuana sales have had to different towns. There's a big concern in the community, especially when it comes to like Rocky Mountain National Park, mm-hmm. on what the effect of marijuana sales would be. Currently, there have been some debates by people in the community saying that we have a special market being a small town in Colorado without a ski area and without marijuana sales, and that there are people who are coming because of that. I would say on the flip side that there are a lot of people that have been interested. So it's really become, I would say, a debate of are we going to allow marijuana in this community? And a big concern of people is the effect on youth and the effect on the town as a community for marijuana sales coming in.
Okay, feeling like it potentially could change the fabric of the town.
Right.
And you mentioned something just a moment ago, and that is about Rocky Mountain National Park. Of course, many people who go to Estes Park are also going into the national park. So
sure.
Do you get the sense of how managers at Rocky feel about this question or how it might impact?
Question with Rocky Mountain National Park, obviously, for anybody who doesn't know, currently marijuana, it's decriminalized in the state of Colorado, but of course, it's still federally considered an illicit substance. Mm-hmm. So I talked to Rocky Mountain National Park, and I spoke with the PIO via email. Her name is Kyle Patterson, mm-hmm. and I just asked her pretty point blank, you know, does the park have a stance on this? And she said that marijuana use in the park was an issue even before it was legalized in the state of Colorado, but they had seen an increase in marijuana use and possession in the last 5 years. She also told me that there's been an increase in public disturbances attributed to illicit drug use in the park. And in those instances, marijuana was often a factor. She also said that Rocky Mountain National Park's view on marijuana in Estes Park was basically, from their perspective, a retail marijuana operation in Estes Park would be, and I quote, inherently incompatible with the national park since marijuana possession and use is illegal in Rocky Mountain National Park and all federal lands.
Avery Martinez is a reporter for the Estes Park Trail Gazette. Avery, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, no problem.
And we just heard about a group of Estes Park residents that got enough signatures to get an issue on the ballot. Now we're going to look at how that process works at a statewide level.
Last week, a group petitioning to change the wording of Colorado's constitution to explicitly ban non-citizens from voting said they gathered enough signatures to get the question on the state's ballot for 2020, although the Secretary of State's office has not yet verified those results. And there's an upcoming deadline for petitioners to gather enough signatures to get a question about reintroducing wolves to the state on the 2020 ballot. To get a better picture of how signature gathering works in our state, we're joined by Colorado's Secretary of State, Jenna Griswold. Welcome to Colorado Edition.
Thank you, Henry. I'm so happy to be here.
So to start, how many signatures are required to get a question on state ballots? And is that the sort of thing that varies at all?
Well, the number of signatures required for a statewide initiative petition is 124,632, which is at least 5% of the total number of votes cast for all candidates for the office of Secretary of State in the previous general election. And unfortunately for petition gatherers, I won pretty big. So that number shifted from 2015 to 2018. There were only 98,492 signatures required, and now it's a lot more than that.
Are there geographic requirements for where these signatures have to come from?
It depends. Initiatives that seek to change the Colorado Constitution, there is a geographic requirement that the signatures collected must contain at least 2% of the total registered voters from each of Colorado's 35 state Senate districts.
Let's say I've got something that I'd like to get on the ballot. How would I go about doing that?
Well, first, you have to file with the Legislative Council, and there will be a hearing to review and an opportunity for public comment. After that, you would have to file with the title board to make sure that there's a single subject and what you want to collect signatures for. And if approved by the title board, then you could submit format with my office for approval.
Okay, so let's switch gears here, and I want to talk about the responsibility of those going out to gather signatures around Colorado. Issues like reintroducing wolves or changing the state's constitution to ban non-citizens from voting are complicated, and I'm wondering if you could just explain the responsibility of that person gathering signatures in informing the voter before they have them sign any sort of petition.
Well, circulators are available to answer questions if they want to, but they're not required to do so. What is illegal is for a circulator to deceive, attempt to manipulate, or offer something of value in exchange for a signature.
Are you able to sign a petition online?
No, not yet. Not for statewide ballot questions.
I'm just curious, is that because it's maybe harder to verify, or is that something the state's going to explore in the future?
That's something we definitely do want to explore in the future. But right now, you know, we have several IT projects, such as our statewide voter registration system and upgrading all the business registration. That's first in queue. But that's definitely something that I want to explore moving forward.
Say I want to sign a petition, but I can't find someone walking around with a clipboard. How would I go about finding that signature gatherer?
That's a really good question. There is probably a lot of information online, or you could always contact the campaign that's pushing the petition.
Let's say I sign something and I read more about the issue and decide I actually don't want to support it anymore. Is there a way to take my signature off of that list?
Absolutely. A signer can withdraw their signature. They have to submit a written request to our office, the Secretary of State's office, on or before the date that the petition is submitted to us.
Can you explain a little bit about how your office goes about verifying signatures, I guess not just for petitions, but maybe for elections?
We have a ballot access team in my office that works with Integrated Document Solutions, which shorthand is called IDS, to process the petitions. And IDS is an office within the Colorado Department of Personnel and Administration. And for statewide initiative petitions, signature lines are reviewed, taking the information provided on the petition, so name, address, county, and comparing it to the voter registration records. For non-constitutional initiatives, the verification starts by reviewing a 5% sample size of signature lines submitted. And then if a projected 110% or more are deemed valid, the petition will be certified to the ballot. If less than 90% are deemed valid, then the petition will not be certified to the ballot. But if the projection falls between 90% and 110%, then a full line-by-line review is ordered.
How long does that verification process usually take?
Well, it really depends. We have to turn around that process in 30 days. And, you know, for petitions seeking to change the Colorado Constitution, petitions are reviewed line by line and every signature line is verified. So it just really depends on the type of statewide initiative petition that we're reviewing.
And this is more a civics question, so forgive me if this sounds really basic to you, but I'm curious to know if a ballot measure passes in the statewide election, does the state have to implement it? I mean, how does that kind of process work?
Well, then it's state law or part of the state constitution. So it would just have the effect of any type of law or any type of constitutional provision otherwise passed.
Jenna Griswold is Colorado's Secretary of State. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Now let's take a look at today's headlines.
Colorado U.S. Senator Michael Bennett continues to crisscross the country for his presidential campaign, even though he's trailing far behind the other candidates in every poll, and he did not make the cutoff for this week's Democratic debate. But last month, he told CNN he's staying in until at least February 11th, which is primary day in New Hampshire. It seems improbable he'll do well there, but it's not unheard of. In 1992, then little-known Arkansas Governor Bill Clinton won that state and went on to become president.
The Colorado Supreme Court says a person who is sentenced to probation can use medical marijuana unless there's evidence that it would counter the goals of a sentence. In a unanimous decision released today, the state's highest court disapproved of an El Paso County judge's decision prohibiting Alicia Walton from using medical marijuana while on probation. It said that decision violated Walton's rights guaranteed under Colorado's Constitution. The Denver Post reports the Supreme Court didn't reverse the decision for Walton because she had already completed her sentence, but the ruling will set a precedent for others in similar situations.
The Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission is meeting in Greeley tomorrow to consider changes to the state's flow line rules. Flow lines are the underground pipelines that connect oil and gas wells to storage tanks. This is the second wave of proposed changes after a 2017 flow line leak caused a deadly home explosion in Firestone. The commissioners will hear public comment on the new rules Tuesday evening and deliberate for the rest of the week. A final vote is expected Thursday or Friday.
Tribes in the Colorado River Basin have been marginalized for more than a century in discussions of Western water development. A few recent moments are beginning to change that dynamic. With a big drought agreement inked and a landmark study finished, tribes are increasingly calling for a seat at the table to negotiate the river's future. KUNC's Luke Runyon has more.
Earlier this year, Arizona, one of the seven southwestern states that rely on the Colorado River, was in the midst of a heated discussion about water.
It's time to protect Lake Mead and Arizona.
That's Republican Governor Doug Ducey delivering his State of the State address in January. His top priority was a multi-state deal designed to keep the river's largest reservoir from dropping rapidly.
It's time to ratify the drought contingency plan.
Within weeks, Arizona finished its portion of the plan. And while tribal leaders in the state didn't earn any accolades in Ducey's speech, they probably should have. A recent Arizona State University report said without the actions of two tribes, the deal would have likely collapsed.
We know that you have to live in harmony with your surrounding community, with the water resources. You have to respect that.
Stephen Rowe Lewis is governor of the Gila River Indian Community. His tribe agreed to lease a portion of its water to other users in the state.
This is a legacy, history-making moment for all of Arizona.
And for the entire Colorado River Basin. Historically, tribes have been ignored and left out of large multi-state agreements, even though they hold some of the most senior water rights. But increasing scarcity in the watershed is forcing unforeseen partnerships.
Early on, 5 years ago, the tribes, you know, didn't think, well, how do we participate in this process?
Daryl Vigil is a member of the Jicarilla Apache Nation in northern New Mexico. He directs an organization representing the interests of 10 tribes in the Colorado River Basin.
Given the senior nature of tribal water rights, you know, there absolutely needed to be, you know, be involved in that process.
And here's why. Last year, the federal government released the Tribal Water Study, which looked at water use within tribes and projected out future demands. One big takeaway from the report gained attention across the Southwest. On paper, tribes have rights to about 20% of all the water in the Colorado River watershed.
And that has to be resolved. Because if we put that water to full development, tribal water to full development in the upper basin, that will absolutely impact somebody in the lower basin.
The river's current managing guidelines, which dictate how its biggest reservoirs are run, are set to expire in 2026. Formal negotiations to come up with a brand new agreement start next year, and all sides are already starting to posture. Celine Hawkins works on tribal water issues for the Nature Conservancy.
I'm hearing more conversation throughout the basin about tribal inclusion in the process. I don't know how it's going to look yet, but there seems to be a commitment to doing better by having the tribal voices at the table this time.
When the tribes show up to negotiate, they'll be bringing their own requests. To get a sense of what those are, I met Selwyn Whiteskunk of the Ute Mountain Ute tribe at the casino in Toyac, Colorado.
This is opportunity. You wanna grasp those opportunities.
One thing he'll be pushing for is more flexibility for his tribe's water rights. Remember the Gila River Indian community, the tribe in Arizona that leased its water off their reservation?
As a sovereign nation, we should have that ability to do that.
But even broader than that, Whiteskunk says the message to other water users in the West is simple.
We want our full allocation. We want our water. We want to utilize it.
That's a message tribal leaders are hoping sinks in, that just because tribes aren't using all the water they have rights to now, it won't stay that way forever. I'm Luke Runyon.
You're listening to Colorado Edition from KUNC.
After Coloradans rejected Proposition CC, which would have helped pay for education and transportation in our state with the money that would otherwise be refunded under the Taxpayers' Bill of Rights, the administration of Governor Jared Polis is having to look for other ways to fund transit.
What is that plan B? Jesse Paul reported for the Colorado Sun that it has to do with the creation of regional transportation districts. He joins us now to explain what that means. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, how you doing?
Proposition CC would have helped fund transportation at a statewide level, and you write that the lawmakers' preference is to find a fix that would help statewide. Tell us about that.
So Democrats in the Colorado legislature have been trying year after year to find some kind of way, a permanent revenue source to pay for the state's multi-billion dollar back road and road projects. And the first attempt came in 2018, really from the business industry, the business community, with Proposition 110, which failed the ballot box. And then lawmakers put Proposition CC on the ballot this November, which also failed. So now after these two back-to-back failures, they're starting to look at what other options they might have, given that, you know, wide swaths of the state don't want to pay or don't want to approve a statewide tax increase or approve a statewide tax question for transportation, while there are areas in the metro area that do want to do that, do want to tax themselves to improve the roads.
The state's backup plan to all that would be these regional transportation districts. Can you explain what those are?
Colorado allows different multi-county areas or multi-city areas, county mosaics, to create something called regional transportation authorities. And basically, you know, voters approve them, and there's some kind of tax to pay for specific road projects in their community. So the Pikes Peak area, Colorado Springs, El Paso County is a really good example of that, and they've had one for about more than a decade, maybe 15 years, where they've been taxing themselves to pay for road projects. They reapproved or renewed that tax increase in 2012, and leaders down there point to that as a really successful model for a way to get local citizens on board with very specific targeted road projects. And you can even do this down to, say, an intersection or an interstate interchange. There's one down in Colorado Springs that's surrounding the I-25 Baptist Road interchange. So there's just like a circle drawn around that that generates tax revenue to pay for improvements at that specific intersection.
If it's already legal for towns and counties in Colorado to do this sort of thing, this regional transportation authority situation, there's only a handful of them. So I guess what I'm asking here is, what does it mean that so few exist now?
Well, it's pretty difficult to actually create them. You have to have broad support and agreement in the counties and cities that are involved in the Regional Transportation Authority. So what lawmakers want to do is tap into existing metropolitan transit organizations like the Denver Regional Council of Governments to give them more authority to create their own, you know, transportation taxing districts, because right now that's not really something that's available. So the idea is to make these easier to create, faster to implement, and really give communities that want to tax themselves and are frustrated by the lack of the failure of all these statewide tax questions to go out on their own and address the problems in their own way.
In your reporting, you write that Republican lawmakers in the minority are skeptical of this plan. What are the downsides?
One of them is that they already have a bonding question, $2.56 billion bonding question that's on November 2020 ballot. It was supposed to be on this year's ballot, but lawmakers pushed it back a year to see if they could get Proposition CC passed. And they say, you know, we haven't exhausted that option yet, and that would call for more investment by the state legislature. But more broadly, conservative lawmakers at the Capitol want to see bigger investment of existing state taxpayer money in transportation. So the idea is to pay, you know, out of what we call the general fund down here at the Colorado legislature, and take money away from other programs like education or maybe Medicaid and funnel those for transportation instead. I think Republican State Senator John Cook, who's worked a lot on these issues, he's a Greeley Republican, told me that he feels like the legislature really needs to have more skin in the game here. And so they see this as just another way to raise taxes. And more moderate Republicans like Wayne Williams, Colorado Springs City Councilman, former Colorado Secretary of State, thinks that, you know, while the Colorado Springs model, for instance, he helped set that up as a really good one for specific communities, the state needs to just find a really good way to explain to voters what they want to do with the money. And he feels like people will approve these taxes if Democrats are more straightforward with saying what the money will actually go to and how long it will be collected.
Jesse Paul is a writer for the Colorado Sun. You can find a link to his reporting on KUNC.org. Jesse, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
In October, the town of Vail announced that it would move forward with a controversial workforce housing development known as the Booth Heights development. It would build 30 apartments, 19 townhomes, and 12 free market townhomes in East Vail.
The project has created tension in a town that desperately needs more affordable housing because of the impact the development would have on a local herd of bighorn sheep. And last week, residents filed a lawsuit against Vail town officials over this development to try to stop it from moving forward. Here to explain what's going on is John LeConte, a reporter for the Vail Daily. Hi, John.
Hi.
I feel like this brings up the tension once again that's at the heart of this development. The community needs housing, but how can that housing be developed without harming the habitat that the bighorn sheep rely on, which is also something that's important to, I guess, the quality of life in Vail?
Right. And the conversation has really pivoted to look at where development could take place in a place that's so built out like Vail. And so do you start moving into your precious lands, if you will? That's really the heart of the issue is, do you build your way out of a housing crisis or do you redevelop your way out of a housing crisis? And you know, I think a lot of experts would say, especially when building your way out involves sensitive habitats. I mean, bighorn sheep aside, there's wetlands and steep cliffs, and the area is already probably built a little more than it should be on some of the sides of it. And so this area is one that should be more of a last resort option, I think a lot of people believe.
How has the town responded to this lawsuit?
So I don't think this is a surprise for the town. I think that they were ready for this and they firmly believe that they did everything to the letter of the law. So, you know, I think that they're ready to take it on.
And so do you see this lawsuit or ongoing litigation affecting the timeline or construction of the development, or is it just moving ahead no matter what?
I'll tell you one thing. It's certainly not going to make it easier to get the project done. And the project already needs more approvals through the planning department. And, you know, that type of stuff, even something as simple as a variance can get very bogged down.
When is construction expected to start in earnest on this, you know, notwithstanding any delays because of this litigation?
You could say maybe it did start. Between November 15th and June 1st is when the restrictions, when they don't want construction due to the the bighorn herd, when the bighorn herd is most likely to be there. So in November, they were on that site with equipment, but they won't be there between November 15th and June 1st, but they want to be out there June 2nd starting. And, you know, they have some more approvals and things to get, but it could very well be that this project begins June 2nd.
John LeConte is a reporter for the Vail Daily. John, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
That's our show for today. Tomorrow, we'll speak with the director of the Colorado Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. And a quick note, tomorrow through Thursday, Colorado Edition will be podcast only due to special impeachment coverage from NPR. As always, you can find Colorado Edition online at KUNC.org or wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Henry Zimmerman.
And I'm Erin O'Toole. Our show is produced by Lily Tyson. Brian Larson is our executive producer.
Thanks for listening. This is Colorado Edition from KUNC.